Funding for Think comes from SMU Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. What legacy remains from the days when lynch mobs terrorized many parts of the country, seeking revenge for crimes real and imagined outside the confines of the legal system? Most Americans are aware of the shameful history of white brutality against African Americans believed to have committed crimes or even just violated social norms. And a new exhibition at the Dallas Holocaust Museum focuses on the case of a Texas-born Jew tortured and hanged by an angry mob in Georgia in 1915. My guest today has been invited to speak at the museum tonight to mark the opening of Seeking Justice, the Leo Frank case revisited. William Kerrigan is professor of history at Rowan University and author of the book The Making of a Lynching Culture, Violence and Vigilantism in Central Texas, 1836 to 1916. And he has a new book out, co-authored with Clive Webb, called Forgotten Dead, Mob Violence Against Mexicans in the United States. Bill, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris. It's an honor to be here.
What defining characteristics make a murder a lynching?
It's a great question, and one that there's considerable debate about amongst historians. As I've been studying this subject for many years, I've heard lots of different definitions, and different cases have been disputed. It's an extra-legal act, so it cannot be, of course, a legal execution, although there are some who think that there was a miscarriage of justice even when there are juries. But historians define it as an extra-legal murder. Usually it has some kind of premeditation about it. It's not something that's done in the passion of the moment. It's something that's deliberated upon. And there's usually some allegation of a crime that is connected to it or some transgression of societal norms. Hanging is the most kind of frequently used means of execution in these cases, but there are other methods as well, shooting, and then in spectacular cases, burning or things like that.
So there's a ritualistic element to a lot of lynchings.
Yeah, to many lynchings there is. Even just a simple act of hanging has symbolic and ritualistic dimensions to it. And in some cases, the ritual is drawn out in excruciating detail and really painful to kind of study and learn about.
And what's really extraordinary is that in a number of cases, the individuals who are victimized had already been sort of tried and convicted. Like, it's mm-hmm. not as if they were not touched by the legal system mm-hmm. for crimes they may have been alleged to have committed.
That's absolutely true. And that's certainly the case with Leo Frank, which the exhibit is going to be is focused on. And then it's also true in other lynching cases, such as African-American Jesse Washington, who was lynched in Waco in 1916, and that's the subject that kind of got me started on studying this very difficult subject many years ago. In both cases, they had trials. In both cases, they had murder convictions, and we're not going to escape, scot-free. But in both cases, mobs decided that they needed to send a message about what these individuals had allegedly done. And so in both cases, they were lynched in very depressing kinds of ways.
So when you say send a message, there's an element of social control in all of this. The message is really for anyone else who might even think about committing a similar offense.
Yes, and I'm not sure that was conscious in the minds of all the people who participated in the lynchings, but I certainly think that that was one of the results of the action, and I think it was conscious in the minds of many of the leaders and the supporters of the lynching. Those who defended it before and after the lynching certainly believed that the message needed to be sent to certain groups of individuals.
Were Jews in 1915 somehow considered less than white in parts of America?
I think so. Anti-Semitism is a complicated subject in the United States. It certainly was a palpable force, and in the South, it was alleged that anti-Semitism was not as strong as it was in the North, in part because there were fewer Jewish residents, no more than 2% of the population, and many of these by 1915, anyway, many of these Jewish individuals had been born in the South and had assimilated to a degree. People will talk about the economic success of many Jews in the South as an example of kind of the tolerance. And, of course, there were Jews who had official positions in Southern government, including in the Confederacy, for example. And however, I think it's also undeniable that anti-Semitism existed in the South. And if it may not have been as overt as, say, racism against African Americans, it was nevertheless a constant in white Southern society. And I think that was a great fear among Jews living in the South, that even though they didn't encounter it in the same kind of explicit way that blacks did, nonetheless, it existed ready to kind of emerge when the circumstances were right. And I think the Leo Frank case proves this, that anti-Semitism emerged in a very visceral, very public, very very difficult way during that trial, proving that certainly anti-Semitism existed in the South.
So a lot of sort of baggage was attached to Leo Frank as an individual just based on where he had come from, because mm-hmm. although he was born in Texas, he was raised in New York.
That's correct. Exactly. Yeah. The fact that he was a Northerner and the fact that he was Jewish both mattered. The fact that he was an industrialist also mattered. And that combination of three things worked against him in the mind of the white public in Georgia.
How had he ended up in Georgia in the first place?
Well, he had graduated from Cornell with a mechanical engineering degree, and his uncle, who lived in the South, Moses Frank, had invited him to work at the National Pencil Company, which Moses Frank had an interest in. And Leo Frank agreed, and he did a 9-month training in Germany to get ready for the job, and then he moved to Atlanta and took over the National Pencil Company. That's how he moved to Atlanta.
And the case that got him in trouble was a 13-year-old employee of the factory, a young girl, mm-hmm. Was found murdered.
That's right. Mary Fagan discovered dead, 13 years old, an employee in Leo Frank's, in the National Pencil Company. And initially, he was not an immediate suspect. The initial suspicion was on the night watchman, Newt Lee, who had discovered the body. There were some murder notes that were discovered with the body, and those seemed to implicate Newt Lee. And so he was the initial suspect. But soon Leo Frank became a suspect of at least of a sort, because he had been, as he admitted himself, one of the last people to see Mary Fagan alive. She had come to collect her pay from him that the afternoon before her body was discovered.
And there were allegations made against Leo Frank by a third employee.
That's right. There was another individual, Jim Conley, a black janitor who worked there, who was discovered some days later after the body was discovered, and he had come to the police, and he was arrested and interrogated, and he eventually came to be the key witness against Leo Frank, saying that in fact it was Frank who had killed Mary Fagan in order to cover up a sexual encounter between them, and that Frank had conspired with Conley to cover up the event and to blame the affair on Newt Lee. Conley said thus Frank was the one who was the criminal in this matter, and he was just an unlikely aide to Frank.
So Conley's story, looked at through modern eyes, sounds like it's full of holes. But one thing that I think is fascinating about this case is that racism against African Americans was such that many people in the community didn't believe that a black person could be intelligent enough to fabricate a story.
That's exactly right. He lied clearly to the police multiple times. He said he couldn't write. He could. In fact, it was later proven that he had written the murder notes. His story had many errors in it, but yes, exactly as you said, during the trial, even in the newspaper, it was published that we don't believe that Conley is capable of making up such a fantastic story. There must be a foundation of truth in it. It's utterly amazing. But yes, racism against African Americans and the belief that they are incapable of certain levels of cognitive thinking played a role in the lynching of this Jewish man.
So did Frank have – talk about how his trial played out.
Well, he had a defense team, and the defense team's argument was that Conley had robbed Mary Fagan and had killed her to kind of cover up his action in robbing her. And in fact, her handbag was never discovered. That was the defense's argument. But the prosecution went with the Conley narrative, the last affidavit from Conley, which said that Frank had this encounter and it had employed Conley to cover it up. They emphasized, attacks on Frank's character, that he had a reputation for sexually harassing women in his factory, and that implying that there was a relationship between Frank and Mary Fagan, and that he was trying to use his power to gain, some advantage over her, and in fact, perhaps did. And all of this was very important in the trial, I think, in the minds of the jury, and certainly in the minds of those who are reading the newspapers outside of the trial, these allegations against Frank and his character. So they had no physical evidence, but they had Conley's testimony, and ultimately that proved enough for the jury, and they convicted Frank of murder, and then a day later he was sentenced to death.
Why did the Georgia governor take such an interest in this case as to interfere with the verdict, or with the sentence, I should say?
Yeah, well, there was a number of problems, of course, that were evident in during the trial itself. But then after the trial, more and more evidence came out that suggested that Frank was innocent. One of those was that the defense attorney for Conley himself, William Smith, a really remarkable individual who had done a fantastic job in defending Conley during the trial and prepping him for his cross-examination by Frank's attorneys. And that was another element of racism that existed. People said no African-American could withstand the cross-examination that Conley was put through unless they were telling the truth. That was another belief there. But anyway, Smith had done a fantastic job. But in 1914, a year after the trial, he came out and said he believed that Conley was guilty and that Frank was innocent. And he actually believed that for the rest of his life and continued to try to clear Frank's name. So that was one thing that came out. But then there was another critical piece of information that came out at the very end before the governor commuted the sentence. And that was that Conley had testified that he had defecated underneath the elevator on, I believe, Saturday evening. And when the police came to find the body, they found the defecation and it had been unmolested. If that was the case, also according to Conley's testimony, the elevator he said that Frank and he used the elevator on Saturday to bring the body down. If they would have, then the excrement would have been flattened, not kind of unmolested, as the officers who investigated found that it was. So that indicated that his story had multiple holes in it and that, in fact, the elevator had first come down after the officers were there. And so this additional piece of evidence, which poked in another hole, yet another hole in Conley's whole statement, seemed to be enough for the governor, who already, he read thousands and thousands of pages of testimony. He really searched hard to kind of come up with the truth of this story. But it was that piece of evidence that led him to make that decision, which was a very brave one that he made.
We'll talk about the consequences of that in just a moment. My guest is Rowan University History Professor William Carrigan. He's in town to speak this evening at 6 o'clock at the Dallas Holocaust Museum as it opens its exhibition, Seeking Justice, the Leo Frank Case Revisited. The exhibit runs through December 31st. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with history professor William Carrigan. He teaches at Rowan University, and he's the author of books including Forgotten Dead and The Making of a Lynching Culture. He's in town to speak at the Dallas Holocaust Museum tonight to mark the opening of the exhibit Seeking Justice, The Leo Frank Case Revisited. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. So, Bill, the governor steps in, commutes Leo Frank's sentence from death to life in prison.
Exactly.
And then, in the meantime, this group that calls itself the Knights of Mary Fagan forms.
Mm-hmm. That's right. So, while the governor was even considering this, there was considerable anger, frustration, concern, outrage among many whites in Georgia that the governor was even postulating this whole move, and they wrote in print that if he did so, quote, something bad might happen. They were essentially trying to encourage a lynching. In fact, the lynching that took place of Leo Frank was very organized, very orchestrated. It had very important connected individuals leading it, former governor, judge, minister, lots of important individuals, and they were able to take Leo Frank, who had been transferred for safekeeping to the state prison in Milledgeville, and to get him from prison without any real difficulty, and then they transported him several hours to Marietta, near where Mary Fagan's house had been, and he was hanged. Soon after he died, a crowd of over 1,000 onlookers came, cut off parts of his clothes and part of the rope as souvenirs, took photographs, which they made into postcards and later sold. This was not unprecedented, unfortunately, in the history of the South. This had been something that had occurred and would occur afterwards.
And the individuals who committed these crimes not only didn't really work very hard to cover them up, but very often in the Frank case and in others, they were made into heroes.
That's right. Yes, certainly. If you read newspaper coverage in the South and in Georgia, their actions were praised. They were, in fact, considered role models that young men should look up to for taking this action to preserve, Georgia's will or whatever they believed they were doing. And this, once again, was not isolated to Atlanta or, to even in the South, but certainly throughout the region, men who led lynch mobs were often praised. Now, there was, of course, lots of criticism of the Frank lynching, some of it from within the South. And in fact, there had always been an element of in the South that had criticized lynching. That was a constant as well, but a minority voice at many times. But in the North and then, of course, abroad, very strident criticism of the lynching of Leo Frank.
What was the response by other Jews in the South?
Well, according to, I believe, Steve Oney, half of all Georgia's Jews left the state after his lynching. So it was a devastating event for them. And some historians believe it was really the turning point in black Jewish relations. And for many, many years, I think that it had a really important effect on the Jewish community in the South. I mean, they already, I think, worried before Leo Frank's case that anti-Semitism was present, was strong, was waiting to be, tapped into and drove a lot of their desires for assimilation and their decisions. But then to see it actually come out in the way that it did, I think, was even beyond their fears. And, of course, it has not been forgotten to this day. I think that one of the reasons that they're having the exhibit on the 100th anniversary is, in fact, because I think many people, and I think rightly so, believe that, in fact, anti-Semitism still exists in the United States. It's still an untapped force that could be mustered by, individuals. And this is, I think it's not the same. This is not the same era as 1915, that's for sure. But one of the reasons it's not is because we have exhibits like this and we remember these kinds of things. And we urge our young people to take the right lesson from this terrible thing that happened.
So in 1986, there was a posthumous pardon granted to Leo Frank, but it did not address the question of his guilt or innocence.
That's right. In 1982, an individual came forward who, and when he was 14 years old, had, according to his testimony, he had seen Jim Connolly carrying Mary Fagan's body, seeming, very strong proof of Connolly's guilt and Frank's innocence. He said that Connolly had threatened to kill him if he said anything. He told his parents. They said that he should keep quiet. And so he did for 69 years until near his death. He couldn't live with it anymore, and he brought forward the story. And it was that admission that led to a new movement to kind of clear Frank's name. And in 1986, it was not a full victory for those who wanted to clear Frank's name, because they did not touch on the subject of guilt or innocence, but they did acknowledge that the state had not done its job in protecting Frank and allowing due process to unfold, and therefore they were pardoning him.
So, Bill, this is all very important, very interesting history, but it has to be a hard thing to get up every day and spend hours and hours mm-hmm. on. How did this become the center of what you wanted to understand in your academics?
Yes. Thanks for that question. Yeah, I've been studying lynching for a long time, and it is a very difficult subject. I say that kind of maybe this is contrary to expectations, that you actually have to be an optimistic person to study something so difficult for so long, because I don't believe that we're destined to go down the same path as others before us. But my interest in it came when I was in college. I went to the University of Texas at Austin, and I had an undergraduate class with George Wright, who's now the president, I believe, at Prairie View A&M. And this was before the internet, and I didn't know very much about lynching at all, and I certainly had never seen any lynching photographs. And he distributed in his class, and his class had 500 students in it, so it was an interesting use of visual materials, but he distributed them, and some of those images were of these mass lynchings. I believe Leo Frank's was one of them, but the one that I really focused on was the lynching of Jesse Washington mm-hmm. in 1916, and that was in part because it happened in Waco, Texas, and I grew up just north of Waco, and so that image, those images really kind of were seared in my mind, not so much the lynchings of the victim himself, as horrible as those were, but of the crowd. If anyone knows those images, they're Fred Gildersleeve, the photographer, had been warned about the lynching ahead of time and had set up on the roof across from where the lynching took place. And so we have really kind of unique images of the size of the crowd from above. And it's the newspapers estimated the crowd to be 15,000 people, and clearly from the photographs you can see thousands, and it's a shocking event. There's people dressed up and they're wearing hats and they have children with them and they're holding children up so they can see all around a burning corpse. I mean, it's just shocking when you see those images. And so the question that I had right from very early stages was, how did these people, many of whom must have been normal folks who, walked their children to school and went to church on Sundays and had good jobs and believed, I would guess, mostly in the law, go along with this? How did they participate in this? How did they endorse this culture of violence? The individuals who actually, did the hanging and were, put the torch to the body, those sadistic individuals at the very heart of it were, of course, important, but they weren't as surprising to me. I knew there were evil people in the world still who wanted to do some terrible things. That wasn't surprising. It was the thousands of people who stood by and allowed them to do it that, to me, was the real question, as well as the people in the newspapers the next day who defended it. That was the question of all of my research ever since then. Everything I've been doing is trying to kind of help us understand that fundamental question: why did ordinary people lynch?
So I have to wonder if you ever vacillated thinking, okay, do I study history in order to understand these questions, or do I study sociology or psychology?
Good question. Yeah, and I did a lot when I was early on. I studied all kinds of things, just reading everything that I possibly could. I even read some accounts of burn victims to try to get inside the head of what it must have been like to feel like when you're burning. Mm. That was very depressing work. But ultimately, you know, I kept on wanting to push the story back further and further, and I came to believe that the kind of origins of this lynching culture were way back, you know, further back than most people who actually studied lynching, you know, believe. If you looked at a lot of studies of lynching, they're case studies, and they talk about the specifics of the crime and of the events that are happening at the time. And all of those are important. You know, that's not to deny that those things are significant. But what I came to believe is that there had to be something deeper in the culture. And so I kept on pushing the story back in time. And my first book, you know, starts in the 1830s, trying to unravel the kind of development of this lynching culture.
So let's talk about that time. This is an era when people in the part of the country that we're discussing right now in Central Texas may have had direct involvement with sort of wresting the territory that is now Texas from Mexico.
That's right. Yeah, there were, you know, violence was just a kind of an endemic part of life in early Central Texas. There was the region was heavily contested. Of course, there were Native Americans who believed the region was theirs. And by the time that, you know, Anglo-Texans came into the region, they were ready and willing to defend it with violence and did, you know, kill a number of white surveyors and others who were in the region. And then, of course, Mexico, which claimed the region. And there was two wars against Mexico during this period. And violence was just an endemic part of this kind of early kind of frontier founding part of Texas history. And, of course, we know that many of the kind of heroes of Texas are these men who kind of helped kind of, you know, shape Texas in these early days. And sometimes the fact that they committed acts of violence was a very important part of why they were seen as heroic.
Yeah, that's really interesting, because if we have declared someone a hero and their heroism involved some violence, then you have to sort of, I mean, you can draw some really inappropriate lines to say, well, violism must be a heroic act.
That's right. I think that, you know, early on, there are all these conditions which seemingly, at least in the minds of some people, justified their violence. I think from today's perspective, we would see things differently. We see the wars against the Native Americans in a quite different way. But at the time, they believed they were absolutely, you know, justified in what they did. But I would say that if you look at the early violence against Native Americans, it looks different from when you're an historian researching it than it does from the popular perception. Most Native Americans in Central Texas were not killed by, you know, organized army units or even Texas Rangers. They were oftentimes killed by kind of neighborhood posse groups that would kind of hear there's, you know, these Native Americans are hunting or raiding in the area. They would go from house to house, round up men and form this posse and then go out and try to, well, and eventually to kill these intruders. And that's not a lynch mob, but I think it's pretty obvious to see that there's a parallel mm-hmm. there between later kind of patterns of mob violence and this early kind of violence. The same thing is true with slavery, which is also, of course, an important part of Central Texas's history. There was slavery was an important part of the economy before the Civil War, and slaves, at least in my argument, slaves in Central Texas were more rebellious than they were in Mississippi or Alabama, in part because the frontier conditions allowed them to escape more often. Mexico was a free border. They escaped to Mexico. They didn't have to be returned. There was no Fugitive Slave Act there. And so what I argue is that this increased resistance to slavery led to kind of greater acts of, you know, violence and trying to repress this resistance. And that also mattered. These slave patrols that went out searching for escaped slaves or monitored slave actions, they also were very similar, you know, groups of white men, neighbors from a region all together inflicting extra legal violence on blacks that they found. And of course, that would continue during the Civil War. And then, of course, during Reconstruction, there was so much extra-legal violence around the kind of political future of the region as, you know, the central government, the federal government try to, you know, reconstruct the South with Republican leadership, and the Democratic white majority resisted that with in all possible means.
Well, it's interesting that this kind of violence persisted. It is, although shocking, I suppose it's sort of understandable intellectually why, when the territory was not fully settled, when there wasn't a sheriff, a marshal, some sort of legal service to go to in cases of disputes or crimes or whatever, needing protection, that people would feel that they had the right to take matters into their own hands, sometimes maybe appropriately, many times not. But as there was established government, why did something like lynching persist?
Absolutely. It's a great question. And I've done some research into, you know, the criminal court records and other legal records of early Central Texas and other states in the West. And in fact, what you do find is that early on, it is difficult at times to get convictions. You know, the courts don't function as well as they do later. It's hard to get witnesses. Witnesses move. It's a fluid state. So there's some truth to this charge that the courts weren't functioning well and all this kind of stuff. Now, does that justify lynching? In my opinion, absolutely not. Mm-hmm. But as you said, intellectually, you can understand the thinking there. But yes, the real question that I had to come up with is, how did this culture of violence and lynching continue later on, after it was clear that there was a state prison system and that the courts worked very well and that was not a problem anymore? And my argument here rests upon what young men in Central Texas thought they needed to do to become, you know, true men in the eyes of their mothers, their fathers, their brothers or sisters in the larger community. And what I argue in my book is that acting with decisiveness and power, even to the extent of committing serious violence, was in fact a sign of manhood. And there was a quote that it's actually in the beginning of my book that I think really encapsulates this belief. And it's from J.N. Bennett, who was the editor of the Waco Weekly News, not a liberal by any stretch. And here's what he said. He said, "Lynching becomes chronic and contagious. Boys grow to manhood with the idea ingrained in them that lynch law is right and proper and worthy of applause, and they follow the example set them by their fathers." And
My guest is historian William Kerrigan. He teaches at Rowan University, and he is the author of books including The Making of a Lynching Culture, Violence and Vigilantism in Central Texas, 1836 to 1916, and Forgotten Dead, Mob Violence Against Mexicans in the United States, co-authored with Clive Webb. He's in town to speak tonight at the opening of the Dallas Holocaust Museum exhibit, Seeking Justice, The Leo Frank Case Revisited. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies program, accepting applications for this fall to design your own Master of Liberal Studies degree at SMU with concentrations in global studies, creative writing, and organizational dynamics. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with Rowan University history professor William Kerrigan, who is in town to speak this evening at 6 at the Dallas Holocaust Museum as it opens its exhibition Seeking Justice, The Leo Frank Case Revisited. You can see that exhibit through December 31st of this year. If you'd like to join the conversation, call us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Bill, to what extent was a sense of economic empowerment or lack thereof tied up with lynching culture?
That's a great question, and I can speak about that from multiple angles. There is, of course, an angle related to that with the Leo Frank case. And then in my newest book, the one I wrote with Clive Webb, where we look at the lynching of Mexicans in the United States, it's clearly an important factor. One of the greatest periods of violence against Mexicans is the 1850s during the California Gold Rush, and there competition over gold mines is very important. Many of the Mexican immigrants that come from a mining background in Mexico and were able to locate mines quicker, more profitably than many of the Anglos who had been farmers and in the north or whatever, and they were the subject of intense violence over these mines. So absolutely, economics mattered a lot, and in many other ways. Conflicts over land in South Texas or over the conditions of labor in various parts of the Southwest mattered a lot. With regard to the Leo Frank case, there was the South was transforming. It was industrializing during this period. And that was an important kind of social, cultural phenomenon that was difficult for many white Southerners to deal with. It had profound implications on gender relations, and it was a major challenge. And it's not surprising to me that the difficulties that kind of came out of this big transition manifested itself sometimes in violence, as it did in Leo Frank's case.
What's remarkable about the Leo Frank case is that very often it seems lynching victims were people who had the least political capital, actual capital. He was someone who would have been a prominent member of the community, and still he was victimized this way.
That's right, and that is unusual among lynching victims. That's absolutely the case. It's not unique. There are other instances of, relatively prosperous, say African Americans who owned land who also were targeted, and there are some other small number of similar cases. But he is, one of the most educated and wealthiest and successful of all of those of lynching victims, and that's absolutely true. I think that to understand the animus against Leo Frank, one has to understand the anger that white Southerners felt against Northerners. I mean, this was not that many years after the Civil War had ended. It still was a very living memory for many of them. In fact, in kind of an irony, I believe, on the day that Mary Fagan was killed, that was Confederate Memorial Day. And so that certainly, it was on the minds of many white Southerners. And by this point, by the early 20th century and the late 19th century, that was kind of the heyday of something called the Lost Cause mythology. This is where white Southerners blamed the defeat in the Civil War on, Northern industrial power. Lee would have certainly been successful if it hadn't been for just overwhelming industrial might of the North. And that story was meant to alleviate, certain, criticisms of Lee for, having not won the Civil War. And it painted the North in this kind of, it's a kind of Leviathan. It's kind of unstoppable. And these greedy capitalists are pushing forward and are bedeviling the South. And certainly the context of the turn of the century matters in that case, because there were lots of factories that were present in the South. They were often owned by Northerners or managed by Northerners like Leo Frank. And they employed child labor. That happened in Leo Frank's factory. They paid wages that were, very low, one-third of that which was paid in the North at the time. And it was difficult on many in the South to send their children to these factories to be overseen by another man, period, and much less a Northern man and much less a Northern Jew. So There were reasons why Leo Frank was a target for many angry white Southerners.
What's the relationship between lynching culture then and the sort of mythology that arises from the stories we tell ourselves about Bernard Goetz in the 80s or even someone like George Zimmerman today?
Well, that's a very interesting question. I would argue that the lynching culture that existed in the early 20th century, the time that Jesse Washington was lynched and Leo Frank was lynched, that culture doesn't exist anymore. Now, it doesn't mean that there's no legacy of that lynching culture, but I think we've transformed to a fundamentally different place. And one of my examples for this is the reaction to the dragging death of James Byrd in 1998. That took place in East Texas, and although from one perspective it looks very much like a lynching that happened could have happened 100 years earlier, what was very different about it was the reaction to that death. The people in the community did not defend it, did not support it. In fact, the exact opposite. They condemned it immediately, harshly. And those three men were convicted. One sentenced to life, two sentenced to death, one already has been executed. And that reaction pales in comparison to the reaction to, say, even Emmett Till's death in 1954. So I think things have changed. And I think the reaction to those events is critical. One of the things I argue in my book is that if you want to understand why a particular lynching happened, you can look at the details of that lynching, but it's actually more important to look to see how leaders in the community responded mm-hmm. to the previous lynching. If they said it was a great thing, if they didn't condemn it, then you shouldn't be surprised that another lynching happens. But whenever community leaders stand up, they try to arrest, identify, convict the people who commit a lynching, then what I think you find is that that lynching culture goes away more quickly than you might think. Individuals can make a difference, even though I guess I've made an argument that there's a kind of a deep culture supporting lynching in Texas. It was never so strong that individuals couldn't make a difference. There was a judge, one of my favorite stories in my first book is this judge who had a lynching happen while he was presiding, and he basically said, I'm not going to tolerate it. He said, I'm going to hold the grand jury. They're going to stay there until they indict people for this. And they did. Now, they didn't convict the people who did the lynching, but they did indict them. Their identities were public, and it made a difference. Even though this happened in, the early 20th century during a kind of period of lynching was flourishing in other parts of Texas and the South, in his region, there were no lynchings. And I think this individual shows that, even profound things like a lynching culture that had 80 years of deep roots could be impacted by individuals brave enough to take a stand. And that's what eventually, of course, led to the decline of lynching culture in Texas.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. You can also send email to think@kera.org. We have an email here from Dick who asks, were any of those who participated in the lynching of Leo Frank still alive when information came forth to prove Frank was not guilty? And thus, did they come to know that they had killed an innocent man?
That's an interesting question. If you're talking about evidence came out, I think, that would convince many people that Frank was innocent shortly, even before he was lynched and after his death. But if you're talking about the evidence that came out in 1982, my belief, and I could be wrong here, but I believe that none of them were alive in 1982 when that evidence emerged.
You mentioned earlier that you do have sort of an optimistic sense of things. Have there been people throughout history who, as individuals, in cases where people had been brought out and were about to be targeted? I mean, what was the fate of someone who stood up and said to the mob, don't do this?
You didn't know this at all, but that actually is what I hope to be my next book. I want to write a book that's a slightly more optimistic one, although still on lynching because that's what I know. But I want to do lynchings that were prevented because we study, of course, those that actually resulted in death. But there were lots of other cases in which a mob attempted to lynch someone, tried to break into the jail, but someone stopped it. Some cases, the sheriff who stands up on the steps and says, yes, if you want to kill this person, you can do it, but you're going to have to do it over my dead body, and I'm probably going to take a couple of you with me. And that oftentimes stands down these mobs. And sometimes, unfortunately, the sheriff gets shot. That does happen as well. So I want to study these individuals who stood up to mobs and saved lives. And I think that there were a lot of those, a lot more than we know about. I think if you look outside of the South where there were attempted lynchings, which suggests two things. It suggests on the one hand that this culture of lynching, even though it's most identified with the South, was not limited to the South because they were trying to lynch people in the Midwest and other places like that. But what happened in the Midwest that was different and maybe some places in the South was that there were enough individuals willing to stand up that the lynchings didn't end up killing the person, even though a mob tried to storm the jail. I think when you study more of these cases, you're going to have a fuller picture of kind of, the 19th and 20th century United States.
That must be an extraordinary research challenge because I would imagine if these things were sort of diffused and they go away, it's much harder. There are no postcards, those god-awful postcards. There's less evidence of exactly what took place.
Absolutely. I think there's there's no doubt it's going to be a much more challenging research project, but I'm fortunate to kind of be, you know, be at a point in my career where I can take such risks and kind of study these more challenging subjects. You know, there were newspapers that did, you know, study some of this initially. What is really different is, of course, there's not as much coverage after the lynching. But leading up to it, they don't yet know that the lynching isn't going to take place. And so there's coverage of it up to the point. And then, you know, there's some remarkable stories. One of my favorite stories, one that I think is kind of the centerpiece maybe of the book, is the story of this Texas Ranger who was actually in Waco kind of investigating another crime when this what looked to be another lynching was about to happen. I was reading newspapers for my first book, and I came across this white woman accuses African-American male of rape and claims that he threw her off a cliff. And I was like, well, this
recipe for disaster.
Exactly. This mm-hmm. is I'm going to flip the next page and I'm going to read about a lynching. And what happened was the authorities took precautions to, you know, protect this individual. And then they found a person who's initially the evidence against him was his shoes fit the same footprint size at the crime. That was it. That was the only evidence they had on the guy. He lived near the area. But then the white woman who'd recovered from her fall in court pointed at him and said, "That's the person." And I was like, well, this is really bad news for this individual. And then the next page was one of the most stunning that I've ever seen in my life. The white key witness, the victim, had been abducted by the Texas Ranger who had taken her to Dallas from Waco. And it was like, what was going on? Eventually, it was discovered that his whole investigation was stalled while this case was happening. And so he kind of started to investigate himself, and he came to believe that she was not telling the truth. And he abducted her and got a confession out of her that, in fact, what had happened was that her boyfriend had gotten her pregnant, refused to marry her, and her brothers had killed this white man. And they decided they wanted to blame his death on a black man, and they came up with this whole story around it, and they thought they would be able to prove this because of the animus against African Americans. But this one Texas Ranger who happened to be there kind of by accident, who didn't believe it, saved this black man, Ivory Clay's, life. And I thought, this is a story that we need to hear about. You know, it's kind of the Oscar Schindler of lynching. You know, we need to study those people who stood up to kind of mob law.
You know, it's so easy to hear some of these stories and be so disgusted by them that we can't imagine ourselves being anything like the people who at least were down there in the crowd. Is it important to sort of search within ourselves and ask whether we might have been susceptible to the same sort of evil winds blowing that made, as you said, otherwise law-abiding people stand by and cheer when human beings were being tortured?
Absolutely. I think about this all the time, especially early in my research. If I had been born, you know, 100 years earlier, what's the chances that I would have been in the mob looking at Jesse Washington as he was burned? And I would like to think that I would have not been there, but I think I'm foolish to think that that's a certainty. Many rational, reasonable people somehow got swept away and thinking that this was okay or at least not worthy of protest. It's the same thing I think you could say about ordinary Germans during the Holocaust. I was an exchange student in Germany and had lots of good connections there, and it was always hard for me to understand how they had stood by and let the Holocaust happen.
William Kerrigan is professor of history at Rowan University. He'll speak tonight at 6 at the Dallas Holocaust Museum, which today opens its exhibit Seeking Justice, the Leo Frank Case Revisited. Bill, thank you so much for being with us.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
Today's show was engineered by Shelley Canavy. Our podcast is produced by Christine McConnell. Lindsay Connect produced the show, and Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can download the podcast free at kera.org/think and send email comments to think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.